Hello, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story, It's Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality they find below the surface.
And oh, do we have one heap of reality today?
Oh, yeah.
Episode 95, we're going to talk about a book called The Catholic Church Through the Ages, A History, by John Vidmar. And yeah, this is not fiction. It is a nonfiction book. The category says history and historical theology.
I guess so.
It's on the back of my book there.
Yeah, once every quarter we talk about either a religious book or movie, break out of the popular stuff, and it was my turn, and you and I had talked about the Reformation.
Yeah, back when we watched A Man for All Seasons last quarter.
And then it seems like after that it popped up every so often.
It did. It just kept poking
and
us.
And I thought, you know, I really... it just won't let us alone. So I thought it would be good to read something about Catholic history because I've read... A long time ago, I read a book called Triumph, The Power and the Glory of the Catholic Church by Henry Crocker III. And it was a great book, a bit triumphalist, which the title would, you know, indicate. And I actually didn't mind because it was kind of nice to not read something that's always putting down the Catholics.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a lot of history books might. But it's not one I feel like I can recommend to people. And I didn't want to delve into all those details. And this one is an overview. And I kind of liked that idea, although it's a 350-page overview, so it's not just skimming on top.
It's 2,000 years of history, you know, so you know, 350 pages is pretty short for that, and you know, I liked it for that. It was great for this flyover, quick flyover introduction. You know, there's a lot of details here and there, but lots of opportunity to kind of find out what period you're interested in, and even directions on where to delve if you want. So I really appreciated this book. I really liked it.
I did too. And one of the things that I had never come across really is he followed the lead of a Catholic historian named Christopher Dawson, who I hadn't heard of before. And he was English, evidently, but he thought church history was best divided up into six distinct ages, which were periods of 300 or 400 years. And he said they showed remarkably similar cycles of growth and decay. And I thought, oh, okay. And when you look at these periods, he says there's an initial period when the church is faced with a new historical situation, a lot of times caused by crisis. So then the adaptation begins. And how are they going to deal with this and answer it? And then so in the middle period, there's this flourishing because everything's being dealt with and it's really great for the people. And then what happens is some other crisis happens. And so the end of an age is the church, he says, in retreat, attacked by new enemies from within or without. And the achievements are either lost or lessened and a new period begins. And when I'm not kidding, I was so surprised at that idea. And when I looked through the ages, it was really remarkably consistent. Were you familiar with that concept?
No, I wasn't. You know, I've read some, you know, it's been too long since I've read Chesterton's Orthodoxy. I think it was Orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. I can't even remember if that's the
Everlasting
right book.
Man,
yeah,
I think.
It could have been The Everlasting Man, but I definitely need to reread both of those because he talked about, you know, periods that the church went through that, you know, it really had no right to survive through. And yet it kept doing it, right?
Yeah.
And, so I'm familiar with that concept, and I was familiar, you know, that we've had more than one low time as a church. But no, I've never seen it presented here as six ages.
Yes, so it's got the early church, the age of the fathers, the dark ages, the middle ages, Protestant and Catholic reformations, and the Modern Age, which is 1789 to the present. And I was telling my husband about this idea, and he goes, oh, so we're in the sixth age. Where is that? How much longer? And I went, oh, my gosh, about 100 years at the minimum. I feel like there's great crisis right now.
Yeah, it sure feels like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But so within each age, he kind of covers what's going on very briefly, but then he'll pick one or two main things to focus on more.
Yeah.
And at the end of each section for an age, he's got fantastic resources. He has reading notes. As he gets further along into some things, he'll also have video notes or movie notes of what you or references that you can go check out and delve deeper. And then he has the notes for each section, you know, basically like the footnotes, but they're not just little references to where he got stuff. They're also some of his commentary or other people's commentaries on things. So it's really rich.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that you can then go on and delve into more.
Yeah. And in the book recommendations, it's interesting that he assigns them an A, B, or C. A being the most accessible and C being the least accessible. And, you know,
if they have stars, he says, you should have these in your library and read them.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So he's passionate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So lots of good books here.
Yeah, but I thought he did a really good job of being even-handed, presenting both sides of a lot of things. And when I saw reviews of it on Goodreads, a few people, not very many, most people said he was even-handed, but a few people would say, well, he's Catholic, so, you know, there's that slant to it. And I thought, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And then I realized when I was looking through it, getting ready for tonight, I thought, well, they might not like some of the stuff he says, for instance, about modern scholarship and the Inquisition.
Yeah, he does say things like, if we talk more about the Inquisition, but he does say things like, well, it isn't quite as bad as, you know, scholars would tell you, but here's the facts that we know. You know, he'll say that kind of stuff. He never says, you know, the church is completely without fault and is fantastic. Mm-mm. And always was, and everybody in it was great. I mean, there's none of that. But
he will talk about mitigating circumstances or things people might not understand all the way.
Mm-hmm.
That was maybe a bad example because it drags us into something specific, but in the case of the Inquisition, when I was looking through it, he was talking about, well, here are two of the most modern scholars, and they're both Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, so you feel like they're going to be a little more careful about it, and here's what they report on it. So anyway,
right.
So I felt like he was really even-handed. Now, if you already have an orientation one way or the other, you're going to like or not like maybe some of the things he says about some touchy subjects, you know, the Reformation, the Inquisition, but this is part of history.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he did a great job.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. I enjoyed mm-hmm. it very much. You know, what it did most for me is make me realize how little I know, which is what a great book should do.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, you know, I come to this podcast thinking, oh, you know, how do I even talk about this stuff? Because I don't feel that I've got a depth of knowledge where I can have opinions, you know, that are based 100% in fact, you know. So, you know, all I can mm-hmm. talk about is what he wrote here. And mm-hmm. Like I said, I like what he wrote. And the whole book gives me a little bit of a focus, you know, because there are two ages that stand out for me that are very interesting, that I am definitely going to spend more time in. Reading some of these books that he's outlined. But we can talk about that more.
Well, the only other thing I was going to say is I was surprised overall, in a sense, I was surprised that he would sometimes draw conclusions that about things I did know a lot about.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of made me think again about my faith. And it wasn't like this was an inspiration. It's not meant to be an inspirational book.
Mm-hmm.
But I would find things inspirational, like he's, excuse me, talking about the 12 apostles. And one of the things that every Christian knows is, you know, oh, there's those 12 apostles. They're not too bright. Sometimes they ask stupid questions. And we all kind of like, oh, yeah, forgetting that, of course, we'd be just the same if it was us. But he points out, he says they were ordinary men. And Christ appears to choose them for their ordinariness. And I went, wait a minute, that never occurred to me. That he wanted normal men who were going to ask normal questions, who were not going to invent things, who were not gullible, and who were not going to believe just anything. In fact, these apostles seem to doubt everything. And then he says, you know, they're confused, they want explanations, sometimes they don't even know what's going on. And then he says, these apostles are key because given all their confusion and doubt, they eventually come to believe in Christ. What they say is not so important, for anyone could have said such things, but it is what they do which rivets our attention. They supply a cogent witness, suffering, and if the traditions are correct, dying for the spread of the good news. And then he says, their deaths serve to notice that they were either deluded or had really seen something. Violent death is not an extreme to which a common laborer will go for a hoax. And I was like, all that made me really kind of focus on them differently and think about how valuable just the regular guy is.
Yeah. Yeah. Not unlike James Martin's book, Father Martin, you know, how it helped us. You know, consider Jesus as a person. And, yeah. Yeah, you know, what you read there just struck me the same way. But yeah, to have them, you know, be doubting all the time and have that be a virtue that he wanted, that's a nice thought.
Well, yeah, and so he's not really extrapolating anything that's necessarily outside of the facts, but it's just that viewpoint of, well, here's what using these ordinary men meant. And every so often that kind of thinking would pop up again, where he was just kind of looking at it from a little different point of view. And it was very enlightening to me.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I agree. Person, yep. So. Yep. Yep. So, yeah, that's all from the first age, you know, what you were talking about there. Mm-hmm. The first, you know, the second age of the church, he calls the age of the fathers, from 330 to 650. And that to me is just a fascinating time. You know, the fathers of the church, it's important to know, you know, the people that criticize the church seem to think that the church should have been dropped, you know, whole and with every possible iteration of anything that could happen.
Yeah.
Explained and worked out, you know, there at the very beginning. You know, Jesus hands him this huge manual or something.
You know, yeah, he didn't even write anything down. He just left it with these 12 guys he'd been traveling around with him.
Yeah,
or, you know,
yeah,
whoever else too. But
right. So when you look at these church fathers and how they, you know, after the death of the apostles, you know, you have that period of a few hundred years there where you know, things were happening and the coherence of what was there is remarkable, but a lot of people seem to focus on the fact that there were differences, you know, there were a lot of people, a lot of philosophies trying to go different directions, but yet this main trunk of the tree seemed to stay intact through that period and then was really defined and, I don't think if approved is the correct word. It was really collected and agreed upon during this time of the church that he says. That's when the Council of Nicaea happened. Mm-hmm. So this 330 to 650 AD.
In a sense, maybe not approved, but proved, like proven as in a working through a hypothesis and a, I don't know, an equation in a sense, as they all talked about it.
That's funny. In my last two inquiry groups, we've talked about two things that you're not going to find in the Bible that were kind of arrived at because of the Bible, but had to be concluded. And that is the existence of purgatory and the Trinity. I don't think either of those words exists in the Bible.
Nope.
But they're both Catholic doctrines. But we believe, again, for those who don't know, we believe in Scripture, tradition, and the Magisterium as sources of information. So it's not Scripture only.
Yeah.
Right. So it's really Scripture and tradition. The Magisterium is the Holy Spirit guiding the church. It's not like, you know, we're writing things down. You know, there's none of that going on anymore.
Yeah, but it's sound like holy, a big council of people sitting around in robes. Yeah. Otherwise, but yeah.
I always look at that. You know, when you look at the last three popes are the ones I know best, right? But when you look at them, you know how they were elected, and especially Pope John Paul II, how that was such a complete shock to everyone, and then who he turned out to be. I mean, that just amazes me. And, you know, that's an example of what the Magisterium is. You know, the bishops that were in there, the cardinals, they listened. And that's what we hope that the church always does. And unfortunately, the church doesn't always do that. But that's what the hope is, and that's what the Magisterium is. But Scripture and tradition, they're the things that we don't believe that everything is in the Bible.
Yeah, because the Bible wasn't written down for a while. I mean, you know, what you had were these 12 men and the other disciples, but they were the leaders to pass on how do we do stuff? What are we thinking? And they were feeling their way too, so.
Yeah, yeah. And then in this second age, the age of the fathers, this is when they're working all this stuff out.
Yeah.
And you're looking at doctrine being, you know, I'm not going to say created. It's being concluded. It's being argued. It's not just this one guy named, you know, whatever.
Augustine.
Even Augustine, yeah, Augustine. If, you know, that wasn't in a vacuum. You know, that was him in community with a whole bunch of other people and him drawing conclusions and talking to people. And that is how the doctrine of the church, you know, and then it became official when they did the councils, like the Nicaea Council of Nicaea. And then there was a Council of Constantinople, the Council of Ephesus. Ephesus, right. Thank you. And Chalcedon. I mean, lots of councils. You know, these guys are developing doctrine.
Well, and the other thing is, too, to remember, and then I think this makes a really excellent point of when it's talking about it, is that it makes – sometimes when we think about it, we think, well, they're sitting down going, well, now what should we talk about? And what's happening is – actually, individual questions come up. There are questions about how can Christ be fully God and fully man? Well, I think it would work like this. And so then people start going, whoa, 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 wait, that puts too much emphasis on this or not enough on that. And how does that mean that we live if we're supposed to be like him? So what they were doing is really kind of just answering questions as they came up. And as various people came up with their ideas, that's what suddenly people would start writing letters about and doing homilies about or sermons about and answering each other with. And eventually certain things would either become so much of a problem of misunderstanding or need to be hammered out some way or the other that they would come together into one of these councils to answer something that was leading people astray usually.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a really organic process. And it's interesting that you chose the Age of the Fathers as something to focus on, because we're watching that happen now with like the Synod of the Family.
Yeah. Yeah, we sure are. You know, and one thing to add to what you just said is, you know, what you just said shows why things like, you know, the Ascension of Mary, you know, people say, well, you guys didn't even say anything about that till 1700 or whenever it was. Well, the reason is it was a response to people challenging that. You know, it was like, it was a tradition. And then just at that time, people were arguing about it.
Right.
Enough that they had to come together and make that decision and say, you know, the Pope didn't just put a stamp on it. There was discussions, right? You know?
Yeah.
There was things that happened before that, you know? So he's not there just making that up. And it didn't come out of nowhere. I mean, it had been tradition, you know, since the beginning, but it just wasn't, you know, declared or made an official piece of doctrine, you know, official in quotes, because, like you said, you know, people were starting to challenge it and say, why is this? And then the discussion really took place then. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's, that to me is how it should be done. It just seems right to me, you know, and I know a lot of people look at that and they say, well, you know, it's just a bunch of men making stuff up all the time, you know, to control us or whatever their reasons might be, you know, their secret lairs and stuff.
Well, and I think you know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why I brought up the sin out of the family, because I was finishing reading this while that was going on, which for anybody, I guess most people have heard of it, but anybody who wasn't paying attention, the Pope called all the, in fact, about a year ago, he sent out a questionnaire that everybody was supposed to send to everyone in every parish around the world. And I got a copy. It was incredibly long and detailed. But so that the bishops could gather people's opinions about family. And then a year later, they all went to this synod, which was just recently, and all of them got together and they considered various questions. And from the way I understood it, he wanted people to bring anything that they had a question about or statements from their point of view so that they could think about it. Because then they're going to go away. Now they've all gone away. And for a year, they're going to think about it and talk about it and work on it and hone it. And then they're going to come back together and talk about it some more and right. See if they have any conclusions, any guidance. And why the synod of the family? Well, let's look at what everybody's always understood the family to be throughout history, and now everybody's challenging that. Is it a challenge that will stand up in terms of church salvation ideas? Maybe, maybe not. But if you don't look at every angle of it from everybody's point of view, how will you sift through the evidence? And so I was kind of heartened to see this was a 2 or 3 year process.
Yeah, sure.
To even and get I was to the too. Point of starting to write stuff down. And that kind of talks about what was going on, like that age of the fathers.
Exactly. And it also shows you, I mean, who the Pope is. And I'm not talking about Pope Francis specifically.
Right.
I'm talking about the office of the Pope, the papacy.
Right.
You know, he's not receiving a directive from God and then writing a document and putting a stamp on it. And now everybody has to do this. Mm-hmm. He's the head bishop, right? Yeah. So this is a process. This is a discussion. It is looking for conclusions. You know, should we change? Should we not change? These are questions, not demands, right?
Well, yeah, it's not even should we change. It's how does this all fit into following Christ?
Yeah, and when I say change, I mean it's not as if a doctrine's going to change.
Yeah.
Right. This would, you know, a change may be a deeper understanding of something that may create some difference in something, but it's not going to contradict some doctrine that's already been established. You know,
right.
Whatever
but
might
they were
happen.
Looking at stuff like divorce and what does that mean for taking communion or not taking communion or,
right.
I mean, just, so all kinds of things that regular people don't think about. So,
sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And another thing that I think about during this church fathers thing, you know, that we look through is, you know, all of our Christian brothers and sisters are part of this same tradition at this point. You know, everybody's, when did the Eastern Church break away? I can't remember. Was that during this time? I don't recall, but it was early.
There's a very handy timeline in the front chapter also.
It was very early, but it may not have been this early.
But at this time,
you know, if you were Christian, you know, you were Catholic, quote unquote. You know, Catholic just means universal.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you were a Christian, we were all part of the same community.
Yep.
So maybe it's in the next. Maybe.
I know. I'm looking.
Yeah, I'm looking at that timeline too. And
if he's put this in a timeline, I'm not seeing.
I wonder if it was even earlier than that. Yeah.
I was thinking Middle Ages, but that might be too late.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
Yep, it was early, though. It was definitely before 1000.
Eastern Schism, 1054.
1054, okay. So okay. Not that much. I mean, it was after 10,000 then. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, but yeah, everybody's in one group here. And
yep.
It's remarkable to think about how recent that was. It, you know, the yeah. splintering of, you know, into so many different denominations. Yeah. But yet this stuff that we came through, that all this stuff that was decided is almost universally among Christians accepted. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody carries the same Bible, you know, plus or minus a couple of books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody believes in the Trinity, almost.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
If you don't, you're much more of a splinter group than you realize.
Yeah.
According to the general body of Christian thinking.
Right. So, yeah, the general Christian thinking is that, you know, the Trinity is the Trinity. So, but yeah, fascinating. You know, that's why I love the Age of the Fathers. Just, that's something that I can't read enough about. A few years ago, I read The Fathers by Pope Benedict. It was a lot of the thing, just do you call those aren't homilies. What is it? When he gives an audience, it's like a teaching. I can't remember what name of it
those was. Were the homilies for those masses, Wednesday masses.
Okay.
But he specifically tailored all of them to follow each other. So they were teaching.
Yeah.
Those Wednesdays were teaching homilies.
That's so
that
cool.
would follow each other.
He really was the teacher,
instead of
wasn't
being
he?
About whatever the... Yeah,
you know, I say he was. He's still alive, but I'm just saying, yeah,
yes,
he got a lot of those books. I have an audiobook that I haven't heard yet called Paul, which is a series of those homilies by him.
I have that book.
Cool.
Yeah, they're all good. All those are good because he did a really great job of giving you a bit of history and a bit of insight into, you know, whoever he's talking about. But then he always had this real great way, as a good preacher does, of bringing it back to you, the person who's listening. What does this mean for me? Because I could sit here and read a history all day long, but if it doesn't tell me something more about me or my relationship to Christ or to others or to the church, you know, it's just a history lesson.
Yeah, that's really a good point. You know, why read church history? That's a really good point. Did you feel like it helped you in some way?
Yeah. Well, yeah, for one thing, like I said, that Synod of the Family, I felt like, wow, this is still doing exactly what it's always done, the church is.
That's
the
thing that it gives me the most, is it's absolutely remarkable to me that Mass was Mass. I mean, we know Mass was Mass at 100 AD,
yeah.
You know, from St. Justin Martyr. So, but yeah, to read this, that's what it does for me, is it gives me confidence in what occurred, and it does clear up some misconceptions.
Right. The other thing it does for me, any history does this, a good one, but this one especially, for some reason, I found comforting, because look at all the disasters that have happened throughout history. You know, there's the plague and, I don't know, all kinds of things. The religious wars with the Muslims, and just, you know, they didn't cover things like Attila the Hun, but he was a huge threat to Europe at one point, all these various things. And yet people still were people, and they still made it through, and the church was there helping them the whole time.
Yeah.
And I look at now, you look at ISIS is out there, and Ebola, and social upheaval in our country, you know, for whatever side you're on, there's another side that's right in your face. You know, there's not a lot of polite disagreement. It's just angry a lot of the time. And so you feel like everything is so uncertain. And I go, but you know what? Although they're about different things, we've been this uncertain before.
Yeah.
And the church makes it through. And more than anything, that's the sign to me that God does not abandon us.
Amen. Yeah, that's terrific. But you're right.
Oh, thank you.
You're very right. Cool. So what is an age that struck you as interesting?
Well, nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
I love it. Not the comfy chair. Cool.
With extra pillows. But actually, I've always been a bit interested in the Inquisition because it's one of those things that people like to throw in your face. Oh, yeah, Christians. What about that Inquisition? As if, you know, I was out there turning the thumb screws last week. But you know, it's valid. If you say that you're here to help people and show people Christ's love and make life better and whatever it is, help them get to heaven, the Inquisition is not really very Christ-like until you start to look into it. And I remember being fascinated, and this talks about this also, is that way back when the Inquisition started, before the Spanish Inquisition, it was a heresy hunting operation, but it was also just the church court. It was the Inquisition. It was the trial law. It was like a military tribunal, but all kinds of things fell under it. And they said that actually they were so much fairer in many cases than the national courts, wherever people were, the state, I guess you would say. So people would go, oh no, I would like a church trial. I think this qualifies. There was a priest there or something like that, so that they could get a church trial instead of a state trial in whatever country they were in. And I remember thinking, oh, okay. And what happened was over time, and I'm trying to think when these – okay, so they started having church courts to settle things in 325,
if I understood that correctly.
At least that's what it says right here.
Yeah, okay. I'm on page 143.
Oh, under Constantine, that's punishment for heresy. So they would have trials about it. But it was about the year 1000 when there started being real problems with all these religious movements and this religious fervor and all kinds of things were being threatened and done wrong. And that's when they started focusing a lot more on heresy, because that's the kind of stuff that was coming up as a problem, which also was interesting because it wasn't like they were trying to hunt down the heretics, though I'm sure some people may have been. But it was like, no, this is just the issue that's coming up right now a lot.
Right.
So then what he does is he goes, and I won't take you through all this, but he takes you through, there are all these steps. You had to do this and this and this and this. And he goes, and it was like any court, some of them were better than others because some of the people running them were better than others. And I was like, thank you. It wasn't because of this big mandate coming down from, you know, the Pope, do it like this. Because one thing that he points out throughout this book over and over is the church is not this monolithic entity. It seems that way, but it's all these little parishes and all these dioceses and all these countries, and everybody's handling things differently and coming into different situations. And now where you did run into trouble was the Spanish Inquisition. And the Spanish Inquisition was actually what happened when the national government took over the Inquisition. And they had kicked out the Muslims, and they were very worried about people who said they'd converted, and they were worried about Judaism for the same reason, because they'd been so threatened by other religious groups than Christian people attacking, that they were applying it to everybody.
Mm.
And so, it was, he says, it wasn't great. But it wasn't also as bad and overwhelming in some cases, according to modern scholars, and we can all look these things up, as popular culture says. And the thing I thought was really funny is he says these various historians, even when they're like a History Channel documentary on the Inquisition, they said, despite all evidence to the contrary, and that's a direct quote, the Inquisition is every bit as vicious as it has been painted. Wait, despite all evidence to the contrary. Wait a minute. I'm confused.
Yeah. Wow.
So anyway, they said a lot of the sentences were commuted, and you know, it said it had problems, but sometimes the problems were things like rivalries between the Dominicans and the Franciscans. So they weren't even aiming it at anybody else. They were aiming it at each other. And so, you know, you just go, I think there's a lot more information than the simple understanding of the Inquisition and the Spanish Inquisition. And this book does a good job of at least kind of opening you up to the idea that, oh, it could be different than we've always been told. You know, like Christopher Columbus discovered America. Well, is it like that? We've always been told that. Well, the Spanish Inquisition was like this. Sometimes it might have been, sometimes maybe not.
Sometimes maybe not, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he doesn't shy away from the fact that, you know, some people were executed. But, you know, he's definitely arguing with the numbers.
Yeah.
He's like, no, you know, here he says, while 100 people might be sentenced to death, only one or two would actually be executed, while others would be hung in effigy as a warning to themselves and others. Almost like a, just a symbolic thing.
Well, and it's also that thing that he points out, and I said about the Dominicans and the Franciscans, even in the Spanish Inquisition, they aimed it at anybody, really. I mean, you know, Teresa of Avila was accused.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, John of the Cross, I think, spent, what, a year locked in a closet or something because he'd been accused of, you know, problems. So it was problematic, like a lot of things from a chaotic time period.
Exactly.
But, anyway, I found what he said to be very interesting. I didn't know some of those things. Like, you know, a lot of times they'd say, well, we condemn you to this. You know what? I'm going to commute it with, say, somebody else. Here, wear a cross on your chest for a couple of weeks or, you know, months or whatever.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an eye opener. Interesting period. So that's in the Middle Ages age.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I just picked one thing out of the Middle Ages.
Which would be what? Age what? Three?
Yep.
Nope, four. The Middle Ages. The Dark Ages were three.
Right.
The Middle Ages are number four.
And I actually have a real fondness for the Dark Ages if I'd have thought about it as an age, because I always love the fact that it wasn't really dark. That's what the people who came afterwards called it. And that was the thing I liked about the Inquisition being, oh, it was awful. He says, well, really, a lot of that talk started up after the Protestants were being pushed out by the Spanish government. They started going, oh, you know what that Inquisition's like? And I was like, well, that cracks me up. Just thinking of that. I'm like, isn't that always the way? Somebody goes and badmouths someone, and the negative is what gets believed.
Sure.
I'm not saying, don't get me wrong, people. I'm not saying it was all roses and sunshine. I'm just saying that's how history works a lot of the time.
Yep, sure does. Well, cool. Let's see.
What about you, Scott?
Then the other one is the next age is age five.
Mm-hmm.
The fifth age, Protestant and Catholic Reformations. And this was of particular interest to me simply because it seems like it's been coming up a lot for me lately. this was a really nice chapter, and I'm going to definitely be reading this chapter again. Just again, as a nice overview, I learned quite a bit from it.
Mm-hmm.
About the things that were taking place. And again, you know, the author doesn't shy away from the fact that there were problems. But what I really learned here was that there was a lot of people trying to reform it. They were trying to reform the church from the inside. There were definitely things that were going on. And then what Luther did is, you know, he brought attention to a lot of the things that needed to be reformed. But then things almost got away from him. Well, they did get away from him.
You know, I really never thought I'd feel kind of sorry for Martin Luther. By the end of this chapter, I was feeling kind of bad for the guy.
Yeah, it's very interesting how this all happened. So the author says he gives three factors for why the Reformation in Europe, this is as opposed to the Reformation in England, which we'll talk about in a minute. But he says political factors, the nations were gaining power and they wanted the church to have less. So that was a factor. Philosophical factors, you know, and you can add to the political factor that the church wanted to maintain that power too. So they're fighting against those nations for that power was a factor. Philosophical factors. Individualism was on the rise and sought expression in religious spheres. This was very interesting to me and something that I didn't realize, but probably should have. He says here, it's a very short paragraph, the individualist philosophy of William of Ockham had come of age and would be a keynote of Reformation theology. Scriptures were to be read and interpreted by individuals, not by the church. Jesus became one's personal Lord and Savior. Jesus had saved me. Religion became, with the Reformation, a personal matter between the believer and God. And that it was a result of the zeitgeist in Europe at the time. This is like the collective philosophy, the direction of the philosophy and the thinking of everybody in Europe, you know, was headed that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not unlike relativism today, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the zeitgeist.
I didn't
think of that. Yeah. It's what, you know, it's, you know, kind of the what's in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing is religious factors. The church was increasingly regarded as corrupt or outdated or simply wrong about theological issues. So people were just becoming bolder in, you know, saying, is that really true? You know, mm-hmm. couldn't it be this way or shouldn't it be this way? You know, this says that kind of thing. And then, you know, so he talks about some of the corruption in the Catholic Church, you know, mostly having to do with money and the absenteeism. That was something I didn't know. I could just imagine.
Oh,
he says this was an abuse directly, but not necessarily connected to the multiplication of benefices. One French bishop entered his cathedral for the first time at his funeral. I was like, well, how do you like them apples?
Yeah, where a bishop could have, you know, what, 20 dioceses reporting to
him.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, as a result of everything that happened, the Council of Trent, that's one of the things that they took care of. And the Council of Trent was another very interesting thing. This occurred over years and years, just like this synod. And the author talked about, you know, at the beginning, they were able to get this many bishops to show up. And then the next year, this many showed up. And then the next year, a whole bunch showed up. And everybody sort of said, oh, this is real. This is a real conversation, and I want to be part of it. And then by the end, everybody was showing up.
Yeah.
I thought that was neat.
I know. I thought that was so funny that no one showed up, though.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm calling this.
I'm calling this.
Hello,
no,
crickets chirping.
No, thank you. Yes, indeed.
We're busy.
So, but yeah, I find it really interesting. And then, you know, we know a little bit about Sir Thomas More.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how the Reformation in Europe related and how it didn't relate to the one in England.
Mm-hmm.
But here it says 3 months after the Christian Nobility was written in 1520, Luther produced another pamphlet putting forth his reform program. This is what finally lost him the sympathy of Erasmus and others like Thomas More, who thought Luther had gone too far. Luther wanted the Mass simplified and celebrated only on Sundays and holy days, in a language people could understand. Private Masses, which priests said by themselves for a particular intention, were to be abolished. Luther also removed the sacrificial language from the Mass, and with it the offertory, which was a presentation of gifts to be sacrificed, etc. So he had gone from, we need to fix these things, to creating his own thing. You know, he was very much, he got to the point where the other people couldn't follow him anymore. So you had people that knew that the church had some things wrong with it, but were willing to stay and fix it. And
well,
then,
and that kind of surprised me because I knew that, you know, people, Catholics were also trying to reform from the inside, but I didn't realize that people like Erasmus and St. Thomas More really thought Luther was right about a lot of stuff until he got to a certain point. I didn't realize they were going, well, that's right.
Well, you know, he was right about some stuff, right?
Well, and I'm not saying he wasn't, but it was just kind of interesting to me that you're always, the way it's told, again, this is Columbus discovered America.
Exactly.
Done.
Yeah, I think I know where you're headed. Yeah.
Luther rebelled, and, you know, the church was getting ready to change stuff on their own. Don't, you know, Luther, you bad thing. You were too hasty, and I still believe a lot of that, but it was a lot more muddied and muddled than, you know, we forget. We see it from hindsight. It's all very straightforward, very clear. It must have just been a mess at the time.
Yeah, it must have been.
And that's what I was thinking. Wow, these guys were reading all this stuff and listening. It was real current for them. They're thinking. They're who maybe writing letters about it. Made it seem very dynamic to me.
Yeah. And me as well. And me as well. And then, you know, Luther was invited to the Council of Trent. But he died very early during that process. And I don't think he ever showed up.
Yeah, you kind of wonder if he would have or not.
Yeah, how that would have been. And then if you want to talk about the English Reformation, this author puts squarely at the feet of Henry VIII. You know, right. And this is something, you know, I think you said during a podcast at one time. But he said, you know, look how healthy the Catholic Church was in England. And then Henry VIII came along and just destroyed it. You know, once that break with the Pope was made, these are things I didn't even know. It didn't even occur to me. I don't know why it didn't, but I don't know of Anglican monks. And it turns out that they don't have them. Is that right? At least in this book, they kicked all of the religious, they destroyed all their houses and gave them away.
Yeah, and there's a set of mysteries that I read the first two or three and then said, no, I don't like them now. But they're told from the point of view of somebody who was Cromwell's assistant. And in the, I think it was the second book, where he is sent to a monastery because he's getting ready to shut it down.
Wow.
And they're very anxious. They're asking him, and he's having to go, well, maybe not, you know, but he knows he's lying. And he's always kind of tortured by, is this the right thing? How does this go along with what the philosophers are saying? And having to worry about Cromwell, you know, taking him out of power. So it's very much of that time period. And so I was aware of it because of that, because those books are really – seem to be fairly historically accurate.
Yeah.
And it was a mess. I mean, because once those people are kicked out, then what do? They can't be priests anymore. Yeah. They have to go to Europe, or they have to hide and continue being a priest.
Yeah.
Hence the priest holes being built into houses, or, you know.
Yeah. Anyway. Amazing. Just amazing. Yeah. And then the last thing that I wanted to say about this that really struck me as really true was some of the reforms that happened to the Catholic Church later. Like Vatican II, for example, you know, some of the things that were in Vatican II even did not, it took years and years and years and years for those things to happen, because the Catholic Church was like, well, the Protestants are doing that, so it must not be right. You know, there was, was a lot of that. Well, they're doing that, so we need to be different from them. And probably vice versa, you know, Protestant churches saying, well, the Catholics do that, so therefore we're not going to do that.
Well, that's the iconoclasm, iconoclasts, and I mean, that's a word from earlier, but the church has got really simple.
Yeah.
No art.
Oh, and just to think about everything that was destroyed, oh, that breaks my heart.
Oh, I know. Well, it wasn't this, but I'm reading also Paul Johnson's, you know, Art, A Modern History. I think I mentioned that before.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the things that he said in there was, at this time, because of the Protestant Reformation, which was, you know, getting everything very simple, the church went in the other direction. They're like, we are going to be very Catholic about this, and be have all the art and have all the music, and we're going to feed your soul through all these different ways that the Catholic, that Protestants aren't doing. So it was a direct answer to that. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Kind of reacting to each other and trying to stay separate, or trying to come together, or, you know, whatever.
The thing I was interested in, I was actually more interested than I thought I'd be in this for a lot of the reasons you're saying. And he's got a good insight. I mean, he's not going around condemning Luther ever that I could see.
No, and I didn't see that either. The thing I
liked is, he was talking about Luther and his followers and the different religious leaders that came up, and he never really was saying anything like, what an idiot, or, boy, that's not Catholic, and, you know, why would you, you're losing this. He just kind of went, and here's what he did, and here's why he did it. But one of the things that did come out was, I was surprised at how many things that we see represented in Protestant belief in this country right now that came from that time period. like Luther's understanding that the sacrament depends on the acceptance on the part of the believer. The belief that one is born again or saved or forgiven was necessary in order for the sacrament to take effect. And remember, we were talking about that in Salem's Lot.
That's right. We were.
You know?
Yeah.
And then Calvin, who was, he was a problem for even people at the time, but, you know, he was like, no cafes, no drinking, or I mean, no taverns, no drinking, body conversation and songs were banned. I mean, he was very strict about all this way to live.
He would really hate this podcast.
Well, we're awful. But, you know, based on his, based on the way he lived, we would already be part of those chosen who were not going to heaven. So it didn't matter. We might as well enjoy ourselves. But you know, that's that morality that no drinking, no game playing, no dancing, no smoking, sex is awful. I mean, a lot of the stuff that people go, oh, you Catholics. Well, you know, that was Calvin. It doesn't mean it didn't bleed all over the place or that, you know, we could go into all kinds of interpretations of when these things are wrong or right. But him say the idea that these things are never okay or just to be tolerated, like sex, I guess, and or, you know, only if you're married and only if you're not enjoying it and all those stereotypes come from this time period when these people were just grabbing this idea and going wild with it. And Luther was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. No, that's not what I meant at all.
Yeah.
And they're not listening to him.
Right, right. They've stopped.
It's totally out of his control.
Yep.
So it just, I was just stunned at the long lasting effect that happens.
That's a great point.
Yeah. So that was really an interesting chapter. I also, my other, we each picked two sections to talk about because we could obviously talk about this forever.
Yeah.
Another one, and I think I was interested in this again. I was prompted to be interested in it because about the time I started blogging, or not that long after that, I guess, was when there was a big furor over Pope Pius the 12th.
Oh, Hitler's Pope.
Hitler's Pope.
Thank you.
I believe it was that John Cornwell, who's one of those guys who's always like, oh, I'm Catholic in spite of the church. I'm like, no, stop it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's that idea that he cooperated, that he didn't stop him the way he could have and all this kind of thing. So I remember kind of being launched into that whole argument and I was very interested in it. And I did know that it didn't come up until the 1960s, aside from Nazi propaganda, and it came from a play called The Deputy, which was written by some Germans, I think, and now I'd have to go back and look. But anyway, all the things the play said were basically propaganda and a play, and they were taken as truth and passed along. And so it was really interesting looking at this author's, you know, timeline of how did, from World War One through World War Two, how did the Nazi Party escalate in relationship to how Catholics were treated and what bishops were worried about and the signing of the Concordat. I don't know if that's how you say it, which was an agreement between the German government and the Catholic Church, which I didn't even know about. But it was, you know, we're guaranteeing the freedom of these Catholic people. We're doing this. We're doing that. And everybody later is like, I can't believe you did that. But the Catholic Church felt like Hitler, and they said like Napoleon, is going to ignore everything as soon as they can. That's not convenient. They said, but if we have a legal document, we can push back.
Yeah, right.
And instead what happens is people look at it and go, oh, my gosh, they signed a document with the Nazis. You know, it's just like, ugh. So
yep.
A lot of what they were talking about is the way the resistance went, how a lot of it wasn't run by the Pope at all. I mean, because again, it's not a monolithic corporation. It's all these bishops in Holland, in Germany, in France, in England, everywhere they are. How do we deal with these situations? Well, I guess not England so much, but you know, all these wartime situations. How do we answer this without getting our own people thrown into concentration camps and trying to help the Jewish people or the other oppressed people? And everybody had a different way to handle it. And that was really brought home to me. I don't think I'd thought about it that way. I'd kind of fallen into that monolithic idea because the Pope would send things out to all the bishops going, do whatever you have to do, or here's the stance we're taking on this. But so he made the point. He said it's not a monolith. If the Catholic Church can't enforce policy, I mean, think about birth control. If the Pope could enforce policy, there'd be a lot different way to live for Americans right now, American Catholics, a lot of them who are ignoring what they don't want to think about. Right. Resistance to the Nazis was very risky, as we know. There was this one famous time when every priest had agreed, I think it was Germany and Holland and various places, they were going to all preach against the Nazis. And the Pope heard about it and went, whoa, do not do that, because that's going to get you all thrown into concentration camps. And so the Germans didn't do it, but the Dutch did. And the Nazis swept through and took them all away.
Oh, wow.
Because they were ready for it. They had targeted the Catholic Church as a big enemy from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. So I liked what he said. He said Pius XII may have made errors of judgment, but he did not do so because he was anti-Semitic or because he liked Nazis. He chose to condemn or affirm things in general and allow local hierarchies to do what they could. Should he have justified his conscience in the eyes of the world or thought about saving those Jews he could save? The ones who were saved were very glad he thought about them and not about posterity. Because he talks about that, you know, they saved 30,000 Jews in Italy. And a lot of times they do things like they'd find out they were going to go sweep through and they'd open the doors of the Vatican and let everybody in and hide them.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
So, you know.
Yep.
But it made me think again, it made me think about ISIS. Look at how all these countries have had trouble figuring out what to do. Even the ones that are kind of in the line of fire. Turkey. Well, we don't want to let these fighters in. Well, ISIS is on your front door. What are you going to do? These are the ones there fighting it. So, you know, it's just, it's so much confusion and you stop. And I fell into that same thing of thinking, well, he knew what he was doing. He planned it out. He thought very carefully. Well, that's the power of hindsight.
Yeah, sure is.
I mean, we can say you did or didn't do what we thought you should have done. You did or didn't live up to your conscience. But I have a feeling all these people were doing the best they could.
Yeah. And I think so too.
Most of them anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and that's so well put, you know, what you just read, the ones who were saved were very glad he thought about them and not about posterity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like this too, you know, he goes through in 3 points, you know, this is how the Catholic Church works. You can't, you know, they have, you know, and I think that that's a mistake that the press makes all the time. Is they don't understand how the church works, and they say things like, you know, why can't this be, or they should do this, and you're like, well,
right,
that's not going to happen because that's not how this works, you know.
Well, yeah, and let's take something. In fact, I think of my example of birth control. That probably wasn't a good one, but let's take one like you're supposed to go to Mass every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
How many people who say they're Catholic don't do that?
A lot. Yeah.
It's 1 hour a week. They're not asking a lot. Do they do it? Oh, we're busy. But I'm Catholic. And that's okay. I mean, it's not okay. But I mean, I'm not saying that you're not Catholic. I'm just saying that if the Pope could pass down a rule, that's a rule that's been in place from practically the beginning. Because it started off as a Jewish offshoot.
Yeah.
So, you know, that had never occurred to me until I was reading stuff like that. I was going, oh, yeah, they really can enforce things. They can encourage you. They can try to, you know, nudge you in the right direction one way or another. Whether it's guilt, whether it's encouragement, you know, they use what they've got.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I had a person one time ask me, you know, Pope John Paul is often said to have greatly helped the fall of communism.
Oh, right.
Just, you know, being a Polish Pope and visiting Poland, right? Mm-hmm. And just showing that the people.
Yeah, and the things they said.
Yeah.
We want God.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they realized, you know, by coming out, I think that they realized, well, they're not alone, for one thing, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the power of the Pope, I think, is, you know, people ask me, well, what do you mean political power? How does someone have political power? And that's a really interesting question when it comes to the Pope. You know, in both things like, yeah. you know, birth control or trying to change a law, you know,
mm-hmm.
or to something like the fall of communism and the mm-hmm. Rallying of people. I mean, he didn't. Yeah, I was going to say he didn't say there shouldn't be communism, but he really kind of did. So.
Oh, well, he did. He definitely yeah. did. And he had an encyclical that came out about when I think one came out before that from a different pope, maybe Paul, the
yeah.
whatever it was. But anyway, about work and man
mm-hmm.
and what's how it should be. And, you know, it wasn't being mean. It was just saying that's just not a normal way to be because you can't trust people to do what they should do. Why not let people, you know, the way the Catholic Church is always let things be done by the most local method possible. There's a nice word for it that I could never think of and you may know it, but it's basically why so much is done at the parish level and not by the overseers of the church. You know, or by yeah. little lay groups of people, lay groups meaning for anybody who's not Catholic, not the priests, but like, you know, this marriage retreat, that's mm-hmm. a lay ministry. That's us doing it.
Right.
Somebody, mm-hmm. a deacon comes and he does some stuff and we go to a mass and yeah, we go to the priest and say, here's what's happening because they help fund a lot of it and it's under their auspices. They're keeping an eye on it to make sure things don't go wonky, but we're running it.
Yeah. And our CIA is a lay thing too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If no one was volunteering, they wouldn't have that thing. And so that's a really Catholic idea. And they do that for, you know, how do you make a living? How do you run your family? How do you, you know, they try not to, despite what everybody thinks, they try not to get involved with how do you live? Because that's what you're supposed to work out for yourself.
Right. So, yeah, I guess the individual is the most local you could possibly be, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And what it made me think of was you were talking about how can they be involved politically. And I was thinking about that poor Pope who was there for World War I.
Oh,
yeah. The one before Pius. I can't remember. Was it Leo? Well, anyway, whoever it was, you know, and they said he was very unpopular because he didn't want anybody to fight. So he spent all his time trying to broker peace treaties and both sides hated him.
Wow.
Because he wouldn't agree the other side was wrong. He just didn't want them to fight. I was like, I shouldn't laugh, but it did make me laugh. I was like, yeah, that's kind of the Catholic way, right? If you're really going the way that you should, maybe sometimes everybody hates you.
Well, Pope Francis did that prayer summit with Israel and Palestinians.
Yeah.
Yeah, trying to broker peace. And he's been doing a lot of that, too, trying to... He's saying a lot of stuff, you know, putting himself in different countries and things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's fascinating to watch. But, you know, it's the same kind of thing. If he had been that pope in World War I, he'd probably would have, you know,
yes.
he would have done the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know that Pope John Paul II would have. It's like, I don't know. He just seemed to be a different type of person.
Well, you know, now that goes back to the idea that each of us is here in our time for a reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
God.
Not that Pope John Paul II didn't want peace. He absolutely did. But I think he just had a way of handling things.
Yeah.
His methods.
Well, he wasn't going to say something was right when it wasn't.
Right.
And for people who weren't really around during the communist regime, and I know this makes me sound really old when I say things like that, but everybody kind of, it's that thing that we were saying about history kind of whitewashes stuff, and it's easy to look back and go, oh, well, I mean, life was terrible in the communist bloc. It wasn't a good way to live. And when somebody like the Pope is speaking up and saying it, it makes it very uncomfortable, whether you're Hitler or Stalin or, you know, some other communist country or whoever it is, or the American capitalists who don't like to hear about they're not helping the immigrants enough, or their job is not to be political in the way we think of it. Their job is to stand on the watchtower and tell the truth the way they see it. And that means people aren't going to like it, because if you're doing it right, you're being, in a sense, a prophet. You're saying, you're speaking what God would is seeing through your eyes, essentially. I mean, and prophets are never popular because they're not here to make us comfortable. They're here to wake us up.
Yep. Yeah, well put again. But that's really true.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, if you're not making people uncomfortable, then yeah, maybe you're not doing it right. Yeah.
Yeah, and you have to comfort the, what was that thing? Shoot. I wish I had my little thing I wrote this down on it. Saint Augustine has something that I have written down because it's talking. I read it sometimes when I look at how busy life is and I think, oh, it could be worse. And he says, you know, I have to comfort the bereaved and cheer up the sad and congratulate the enthusiastic. And, you know, he's basically, here are all the people I have to deal with every day, because he was a bishop. And then at the end, you know, he says, chide the proud and encourage the downhearted and all these various things. And he goes, and then at the end he says, all must be loved.
Mm.
That's what that is doing that. I mean, you know, the people who need to hear that they're not going the right path need to hear it. But at the same time, the people who need the encouragement, the people who need the help, I mean, that's a good priest, a good pope, and hopefully us as Christians, we're able to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
that's what we're called to do, right?
Yeah. Whether, now how good I am at it, don't ask anyone. Please.
Love God and love each other. Those are the big two.
Yeah.
Yep.
So simple and yet so hard.
So difficult.
Why is that? Why is that?
So simple. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, I thank you very much for picking this book.
Oh, I'm so glad you liked it. Yeah, I really did. Mm-hmm. Myself with, since it was, I'd never read it, so it was a real flyer.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah,
but it's definitely worthwhile. Yeah, and it's not that big, 350 pages or so. You know, most of these books, you know, when you see them, the history books are like, you know, it's 800 pages, and it's just like, okay, well, that's going to take me a while. I'll read this other thing first.
Yeah, and I'd say if you're not Catholic and you're interested in, oh, any of these, I mean, you know, the Crusades, the whatever. I mean, he doesn't spend as much time on some things, but this is at least a good place to start and get the context.
It's an absolute perfect thing for that. Context, then, flyover, summary. You come away with this to have, you've got a framework, you know where everything fits, and it's very well written. It's very easy to read.
And his recommendations are, you know, there for the more in-depth books. And then even if you wanted to go to other authors, at least you have this viewpoint also.
Right.
I mean, I think he's very even-handed. And I would guess from the few books that I did know that I saw in there, I really thought those were some great books.
Mm-hmm.
Very even-handed. So I recommend it, definitely.
Me too.
Thank you, John Vidmar.
Thank you, John Vidmar. Right. OP.
Yes. Yes, we'll have to send him a link or a tweet.
Yeah, that would be great. Let's do that.
Yeah.
Let's do that. Well, good. All right. So what have we got coming up next? A movie from China.
China. Hero.
Hero. I love it. That's going to be great.
Mm-hmm.
And then right next to me here, I have The House of Breed, In This House of Breed.
Ah.
So it's here and ready to be read.
And how interesting, since we were just talking about the Reformation, and this is a monastery or a convent in England, of course, much more modern times, when they're allowed to be back, you know.
Cool.
Yeah.
So, yeah, is it true that there are no Anglican monks?
I'm going to have to hit Google on that. I didn't think
it's because nothing's leaping to mind. Maybe I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm. I don't know either. This is the big question.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a question that I will find the answer to.
Okay.
All right.
I want to know.
And then that brings us to December the 19th.
It does.
And a Christmas movie. We're going to talk about It's a Wonderful Life by Frank Capra, a movie that almost no one has seen.
It's a wonderful movie, though.
It really is. I racked my brain trying to come up with one, and I was like, ah, but I just love that. So yeah. We're going to talk about that movie.
Yeah, well, you know, favorite books and movies we love. That's isn't that it?
That is it, yep.
Yeah.
For sure, for sure. Yeah. That'll be it for the year. Can you believe that?
Wow. How many, is this 3 years?
Jeez. 94, well, we've done 95. No, this is our fourth year that's finishing. 4 years. Isn't that amazing? Because if we did one every 2 weeks, should have... 26 a year.
Yeah.
If we hit all the weeks.
We're coming up on 100.
We are coming up on 100. Yes. I'm really looking forward to that.
So when do we want to talk about that?
I don't know. When it gets closer, probably.
Okay. All right. Never mind everything. We'll tell you later.
You bet. You bet. I love it.
Okay.
Cool. All right. Okay. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
And, yes.
Do read the book. You. It's fun.
Yes.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.